Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the First World War took place nearly 100 years ago, the world is still dealing with the consequences of the war and the borders created afterwards. Nowhere is this felt more keenly than the Middle East. While Scott Anderson's book is titled Lawrence in Arabia and is nominally about T.E. Lawrence's role of leadership during the Arab Revolt, the book also looks at the larger picture of the great game afoot by European powers who hoped to divide the Middle East among themselves, all the while promising Arab independence. The artificial borders and the rulers and ruling classes set in place still inform geopolitics in the Middle East to this day. Scott Anderson is the author of Lawrence in Arabia, a veteran war correspondent who's covered conflicts from Chechnya to Northern Ireland, El Salvador to the Sudan, and of course the Middle East. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and his work has appeared in Vanity Fair, Esquire, and Harper. He's also the author of two novels and four works of nonfiction. His latest book is titled Lawrence in Arabia, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Scott Anderson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. My pleasure.
While the title of your book suggests that T.E. Lawrence is indeed the focus of the book, you also tell us the wider story of the Middle Eastern Front and the story of events of over coming up on 100 years now that are still with us today. What inspired you to write this story about the Middle Eastern Front as well as about T.E. Lawrence?
Well, as a journalist, I've spent a lot of time over the past 25 years in the Middle East and in the various war zones there. And what I discovered is whenever I'd have a detailed conversation with somebody, invariably they would trace the roots of their problems back to the end of World War I, and in particular the artificial borders that were created at the Paris Peace Conference immediately after World War I. So I'd always had in my mind that I wanted to explore that period of history, and I'd always been fascinated by T.E. Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia. I'd seen the movie as a kid and been thoroughly enraptured by it. And from that, in thinking about trying to write something new about Lawrence, because there have been some 70 or 80 books written on him over the years, I was thinking about the kind of core riddle that lies in his story, which is, how did he do it? How did a 28-year-old Oxford scholar, without a single day of military training, how did this man go off to Arabia and end up being the battlefield commander of a rebel army? And in thinking about that riddle, it occurred to me that really the answer is that no one was paying much attention. This happened in the midst of World War I. Certainly almost all British and French attention was devoted to what was happening on the Western Front. So if somebody could go off and cause problems for the Turks, who were allied with the Germans in Arabia, then go to it. And so Lawrence had this incredible freedom of movement. And when I kind of had that epiphany about Lawrence, I got thinking, well, if that was true for the British, who were certainly by far the biggest imperial players in the region, then it must have been true about the other warring factions. And so from there, I went out and found these other characters. And so while Lawrence is still certainly the foremost character in the book, there's a small group of other characters around him.
The way you describe it, Lawrence was the perfect man in the perfect place. He had the knowledge of the area. He had the knowledge of the customs of the Arabs because he had spent some time on some archaeological digs and spending time in the Middle East. He knew the area, and he also had this great sense of, you know, he studied medieval history, and he was actually a medievalist, if you will.
That's right.
And this was the perfect warfare for the Middle East, at least during World War I.
That's exactly right. Those were Lawrence's two great strengths going into the Arab Revolt. He had spent time in northern Syria before the war on an archaeological dig. He'd spent pretty much 3 or 4 years up there. And during that time, he'd really studied the way, he was almost more of a cultural anthropologist than an archaeologist. He really studied the way the clan and tribal structures in the area worked, and you know how feuds and vendettas could go on for centuries. And that became even more exaggerated or amplified in Arabia. And the second thing, as you mentioned, because he had studied military history, especially European medieval military history, say of the 14th century, well, in Arabia, warfare in the early 20th century looked an awful lot like warfare in Europe in the 14th century. It was war at its most primal level. So, you know, where you attacked, who you attacked, and when was determined by water, where you'd be able to find water, where you'd be able to find forage for your animals, how'd you be able to make an escape route. So in this unique way, Lawrence had a grasp of how to wage war in Arabia that an actual professional British officer or any European military officer trained in Napoleonic concepts of war would be utterly baffled by.
And the other thing that was really interesting, and this gets into the situation where most of us know T.E. Lawrence through Peter O'Toole's portrayal in the movie, Lawrence of Arabia. And the interesting thing to me was his makeup, was that we remember him riding the camel across the desert, which he did on several occasions in these feats of physical endurance. This was a part of his makeup, even from his school days in the U.K.
That's right. When he was in eighth grade, there I came across this note by his teacher in eighth grade, or third form, it would be in England, that talked about how Lawrence seemed to be immune to any concepts of either pleasure or pain, that he was a true stoic. And he would do these tests, even as a very early teenager, where he would test the limits of his endurance by, he would go days without eating or sleeping or drinking water. And he would do these tests to push himself to the point of collapse. And, of course, this stood him in very good stead when he got to Arabia, where, you know, it's a brutal landscape. And he would go on these treks for hundreds of miles on camel and living on, literally on many of these, the only food they were carrying with him was flour. And they'd mix flour with water, and that was their sustenance for weeks on end. And this also helped bring the loyalty of the Arabs who were with Lawrence, because for the first time they saw a Westerner. They always, to the degree they had any contact with Westerners, they saw them as soft and lazy. And in Lawrence, they saw a man who was just as tough as they were.
And in fact, that reputation actually began before the war when he was working on archaeological sites. He worked as hard as the Arabs, which most Westerners would, you know, sit under the umbrella and watch the guys
That's
work.
Right. And, that's right. And
there's this amazing story where he's wanting to take a walking tour of, I think it's Syria or in the Lebanon. And the Turkish commander of the area says, well, you need an escort. He's walking with a cavalry escort sort of following behind him as he walks, because he was probably the least imperial Westerner that that area had ever seen.
Absolutely. And that the walk you're talking about, that's when he was still a student at Oxford. And he was, again, he was studying medieval military history. And he got this idea that he wanted to visit the Crusader castles in Syria. And in typical Lawrence fashion, he wasn't just going to go to a few of the major ones. He wanted to go to all of them, and there are 60, 70, some odd Crusader castles. And he was going to walk. He was going to go by himself, and he was going to go in the summer, during his summer break, when inland Syria routinely gets to 120 degrees. So the few people, the few Britons who knew Syria and heard about his plan, they all said he was crazy to do this. But Lawrence set off. He was 20 years old, and he walked 1,200 miles across Syria. And the story you mentioned, the locals were just so stunned at the sight. And also, the other thing about Lawrence is he was only 5'3". So at the age of 20, and very clean cut, they thought he was 13 or 14. And so this kid shows up in their village. And so the anecdote you were mentioning is this a local governor general was just so stunned at the sight of Lawrence rolling into his town that as Lawrence was going on to the next town, to the next Crusader castle, he insisted on sending a troop of cavalry to guard Lawrence, and they traveled with him for days. So.
And that was really the interesting thing. One of the things I learned about the Ottoman Empire in this particular day was how diffuse the rule was and how catering to Westerners the Turks were.
Right. The Ottoman Empire is a fascinating, the whole system they had, and it was called the Milliyet system, and it's really the key to why the Ottoman Empire, which militarily was far weaker than the European imperial powers, you know, through the 16th, 17th century. But under the Milliyet system, what they did is it was a very decentralized system where different ethnic and religious groups had almost full autonomy to rule themselves, and as long as they paid their taxes and met the military conscription rates of their population, they were pretty much free to govern themselves, and with very little authority coming down from Constantinople, the capital. And this was a real key to the success of the Ottoman Empire, because most groups had nothing really to rebel against. I mean, no one likes paying taxes, but when you compare the freedom that Christians, Jews had under Ottoman rule. It was vastly more freedom than they would have had under, you know, Western empires. And that you mentioned that the sway of the European powers within the Ottoman Empire, what had happened, and it goes back to the 1600s, because there was such a huge Christian population, especially in Syria and in Armenia, the European powers had basically forced themselves on the Ottomans as the protectors of their Christian population. And so they had this incredible, it's bizarre how much power they had within, that the Europeans had within the Ottoman Empire, to the point that by the beginning of the 20th century, a Westerner or a European committing a crime in the Ottoman Empire couldn't be tried by Ottoman courts. He had to be tried by some envoy from his own country. So there was this, they had this incredible freedom, and which was often, of course, often abused within the Ottoman Empire.
And that brings in the other three people that you profile that were a part of this time during the First War and in the years leading up to it. First is a German spymaster diplomat named Kurt Prüfer.
Right.
Prüfer was, again, working freely throughout the area prior to the war, and then, of course, was a spymaster during the war.
That's right. And a very similar biography to Lawrence. He was 3 years older than Lawrence, but so in his late 20s, early 30s. But very similar to Lawrence, he also had never had any military training. He was an Oriental scholar and a linguist, really. And he had gone out to the Ottoman Empire as a young man and had worked at the German embassy in Cairo. And then when the war started, he spoke a number of languages fluently from the region. He came back as an intelligence officer for the Germans and ended up being the head of German counterintelligence in Syria.
Another character is William Yale, who was of a high-powered American family, but they had lost their money, and he was working for Standard Oil. But eventually, when war came, he became sort of somewhat of a spy for the Americans and just became an intelligence agent, freelance, really.
That's right. He was, because the Americans didn't come into the war until 1917, so 3 years into the war. So during the first 3 years of the war, William Yale was living in Jerusalem, and he was watching over Standard Oil's oil concessions that he had managed to get from the Ottomans throughout Palestine. When the war started, he had to leave because he was now a belligerent foreigner, as they would refer to it then. He came back to the U.S., and he was hired on by the State Department to be a special agent for the Middle East. And so he was the only, just to give you an indication of how parochial and closed off from the world the United States was at the time, he was the only American field intelligence officer in the Middle East during World War I. So he was pretty much the American sole source of information of what was happening in that region.
And after the war, he became like the main expert on the Middle East, which is shocking, as shocking to him as it might be of readers of the book.
That's right. There's this great anecdote where when the war was over, when the Paris Peace Conference was starting, he was attached as a so-called expert for Arabian affairs to the American delegation of the Paris Peace Conference. So the day he arrives in Paris, his new boss hands him a 107-page briefing book called a Report on the Desires of the Syrian People. And his boss says, study this because this is the basis for our entire policy in the region. So William Yale starts looking through this briefing book, and virtually all the citations are from William Yale. it's amazing. It was over 90% of the contemporary citations were from the reports that he'd been sending in from Cairo. So it didn't require a lot of study on his part.
My guest today is Scott Anderson. He's a foreign correspondent, been in many war zones, a writer for the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, and Harper's, among others. His new book is titled Lawrence in Arabia: War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. It's published by Doubleday. It's ostensibly the story of T.E. Lawrence, but it's also the story of the greater region when the borders that the Arabs are fighting over and who's going to rule these lands, this is when this was all made in the wake of World War I. One of the big things that happened, even as the war was being fought, and it was sort of a war of imperialism, is already the West is thinking about, if they win the war, what are they going to take? And this ends in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which So much of this history we know from the movie, which is not necessarily accurate. This was in force, really, as the Arab revolt just got underway.
That's right. What had happened was, in order to entice the Arabs in Arabia, or in the Hejaz region of Arabia, to revolt against the Turks, the British had entered into this agreement with King Hussein of the Hejaz. In return for the Arabs rebelling, there would be sweeping Arab independence throughout almost the entire Middle East. The British reserved a couple of small enclaves for British and French rule, but virtually the entire Middle East was going to be independent.
And that would be from the top of Syria all the way to the Iranian border, or what would...
That's right. Yeah. And all the way down the Arabian Peninsula to... There was a couple of little sheikdoms that were independent, but virtually the entire Arabian Peninsula, what we would today, most of Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and present-day Israel. So virtually that entire region was going to be an independent state. The British then turned around and made a secret deal, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, with the French, which... And now on the new map, quite unbeknownst to the Arabs, the British and French carved up virtually the entire, you know, any place of any economic potential between themselves. And now the new independent Arab nation was going to be limited to basically the sand wastelands of the Arabian Peninsula. But, of course, the British didn't inform the Arabs of this amendment. And the crucial role Lawrence played in this, because he was with the military intelligence unit in Cairo, so he knew about both the promises made to King Hussein, and he also knew about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And when he started fighting with the Arab rebels at a crucial juncture in early 1917, he told his main Arab ally, Faisal, about the existence of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. So, and technically committed treason by doing so. This was a top-secret diplomatic accord, and to reveal that to a third party in a time of war, it almost defines treason. But Lawrence, by that point, had already come to so identify with the Arab rebel cause that he felt he needed to be warned what was in the works.
And I guess he felt like if the Arabs proved themselves on the battlefield, they spilled their blood for this cause, they would be rewarded. And this is one of the interesting things I'd never heard of in sort of the colonial unwritten rules that you had to have blood in the game to claim something. And this is something the French didn't.
That's right. And no, it was this very kind of old-fashioned notion that you almost physically had to plant your flag. And if you didn't have soldiers, as you said, if you didn't have blood in the game, then your claim to any place was certainly less legitimate. So what Lawrence spent most of once the Arab revolt started in the summer of 1916 and for the next 2 years until the war was over, it was constantly trying to figure out how he could subvert both French and British imperial designs on the region and pushing the Arabs to physically take as much of Arabia and Syria as possible, because it was only through physically taking the land that they could then lay claim to it.
You know, as I've said a couple times, most of us know this story through Lawrence of Arabia. What is best accurate about that movie for what actually happened, and what is terribly inaccurate about that movie?
You know, I think there's a reason that movie is still a classic 51 years later, and I think... In this very funny way, by getting almost all the historical facts wrong, it somehow, in some bizarre way, it ends up arriving at kind of a greater truth, a kind of an essential truth. And I think that's especially true about how Lawrence is portrayed. Lawrence was deeply conflicted by the role he was playing. He referred to himself as a fraud and as a charlatan, because he was there essentially as an agent of the British Empire, but enlisting Arabs to fight with the promise of independence, knowing full well that, in fact, they were probably going to be betrayed in the end. And I think this is something that the movie gets across very well, that he became this kind of a Shakespearean tragic figure, kind of an anti-hero. And also just how deeply scarred he became by the war and by the physical combat that he was constantly subjected to and often initiated. And Lawrence did a lot of kind of awful things during the war, of executing prisoners, taking no prisoners. And I think that that comes across in the movie of you know, just the psychic damage that the war, as the war went on, that Lawrence was increasingly feeling.
Now, we also in the book read about Faisal, who is the son of King Hussein, who was running the Hejaz, was the king of that part of Arabia, which is not the ruling family of Saudi Arabia today. That is the House of Saud. That was another group that came in and basically booted Hussein out. But
right.
His sons, Faisal, Abdullah, they ended up ruling portions of, at least as figureheads, at least at the beginning under the protectorates of the Western powers. But Faisal strikes me as a really interesting character. And Lawrence attached himself to Faisal very early. Of the four sons, he was the one who thought that could bring the Arabs together.
That's right. And it says something about Lawrence, because when the Arab revolt started in June of 1916, and Lawrence didn't get to Arabia, his first trip to Arabia, and the trip itself was kind of a lark. He took time off. He had free time coming to him, so he basically used vacation time to tag along with a friend to Arabia who was administering the Arab revolt. And Lawrence instantly figured out that Faisal, he called him the prophet of war, that what the Arab revolt needed to go forward was a prophet, an armed prophet. And at that time, everybody in the British hierarchy considered Abdullah, Faisal's older brother, to be the leader of the battlefield commander of the Arab rebels. And it was Lawrence alone who thought the real leader was Faisal. And he proceeded to make that happen. In about a month after his first trip, he came back over. He attached himself as the liaison to Faisal. And as time went on, Faisal and Faisal's men bore the brunt of the fighting throughout Arabia and Syria.
It's interesting, though, that where these families ended up, the descendants, Faisal ends up in Iraq.
Right.
Abdullah ends up in the Transjordan. That
right.
House still rules in Jordan.
That's right. You're right. So Hussein, the father, was of the Hashemite dynasty, and that ruled Hejaz. And to go back to something you were saying earlier about the Ibn Saud was from the eastern Arabian Peninsula, and extremely conservative. His followers were Wahhabis, which is the most severe form of Islam, and by Hussein not being able to deliver on the promise of Arab independence at the war, by having essentially been duped by the British and the French, Hussein lost a huge amount of legitimacy in the eyes of the Arab people. And Ibn Saud used this to overthrow Hussein in 1925. Interestingly, while all this was going on, Ibn Saud was also on the payroll of the British government, just as Hussein was. So the rise of Ibn Saud, and now, of course, Saudi Arabia is named from the House of Saud, they thought that, you know, they had all their bases covered. But, of course, when Ibn Saud came in, he now, and then shortly after that, oil was discovered in the Arabian Peninsula. Among the Saudi princes, this idea of living in Bedouin tents out in the desert lost a lot of appeal to them. So they basically cut the deal with the Wahhabis who had brought them to power, that as long as the Wahhabis exported their Islamic Jihad ideas, the House of Saud would continue to bankroll them, as long as they left the power structure in Saudi Arabia alone. And, of course, this arrangement ultimately, the most famous product of this arrangement was Osama bin Laden.
Yes. Interesting. Faisal had some very interesting ideas about this post-war greater Arab empire, if you will. And one was kinship with the increasing number of Jews coming to Palestine, in which that would be incorporated into it. It offers some intriguing notions. If this had actually occurred, how the Middle East would be different today. Saud might not rule Saudi Arabia. Maybe these conflicts that seem to be so strong between Israelis and the Arab population might have been subsumed.
That's right. And I have to say, when doing the research on this book, and I think some of it comes across in the book, you see so many moments where it's kind of excruciating at times that there's so many moments where things could have turned out differently and you know, for the better. And just so many missed opportunities. Yes, right, immediately after the war, at the Paris Peace Conference, Faisal made an agreement with Chaim Weizmann, who was the head of the British Zionists, and that in return for recognizing an increased Jewish presence in Palestine and perhaps eventually leading to a Jewish state, that in return for that, the Zionists would support Faisal's claim, or the Arabs' claim, to the rest of Syria. And so they made this agreement right at the eve of the Paris Peace Conference, but it was just completely ignored.
Hmm. You know, the one takeaway I take from this book, that it's interesting that in the years and decades right after World War II, the conflicts, whether it's war of words or wars of deeds, were driven by the forces of that war, the Cold War. Mm-hmm. But since the end of the Cold War, it seems like now we're paying the price for the mistakes in the aftermath of the First World War. You know, you look at the conflict in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Of course, that was a created state from World War I. Africa, as the African colonies there, and today, and still, the greater Middle East.
Right. Oh, it's, you know, to a degree that I hadn't really appreciated. I think that so much of the history of the 20th century, it really starts with World War I. I mean, it's, yes, you mentioned the Balkans, the artificial borders created in the Middle East, but also the rise of communism, the rise of fascism, and ultimately the Cold War. Vietnam War. I think almost everything sort of ties into it. All kind of started in 1914, and of course World War II. There's a lot of historians who don't even think of in terms of there being two world wars. They say there was one world war with a long sort of uneasy rest period in between the two. And just the incredible hubris and arrogance of the imperial powers that, you know, stumbling into this abyss of World War I, and we're absolutely living with the consequences 100 years later.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. Lawrence in Arabia. Scott Anderson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. My pleasure.
Scott Anderson is the author of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.